Hello everyone, welcome back. So we're gonna switch gears a little bit now. We're gonna have the presentation from Edalc Mecuria from Universitat Oberta de Catalunya, and he's gonna present on affirmative action and other forms of positive discrimination in relation to theories and principles of justice. Y la contraponencia va a estar a cargo de Gonzalo Fernández. Y bueno, entonces 25 minutos para la ponencia principal, 25 minutes for your presentation y 10 minutos para la contraponencia. Entonces, okay. The floor is yours.
Thank you. Hello everyone. My name is, as I'm already introduced by the chairman, my name is Edalc Mecuria Mokria. I'm a PhD student at WOC, and I'm here with my supervisor, Dr. David Martinez, and I'm very glad to be here and to be given this opportunity. So the title of my presentation or discussion is, it's part of my ongoing PhD dissertation. It's about affirmative action and other forms of positive discrimination in light of theories and principles of justice, but specifically today I would say it theory and principles of justice, because I will be very focused and specific about Rawls's theory of justice. So, I think this works. So, the structure of the presentation looks like this. I'm gonna talk about the institutional problem, the normative framework, the structure. I have also some tests from the dissertation, and I will talk about Rawls, and I will give you some conclusions. So, just to begin with, let me talk about selection gates. So as you know, liberal societies allocate most of consequential opportunities through institutional selection procedures. For example, if you take it, college admission, public office appointment, professional careers, you know, public contracts. So these decisions occur under conditions of scarcity. So selection rules sort out individuals according to publicly defended criteria. So why selection rules matter? So selection rules do more than, you know, distribute benefits. So they express public judgments about merit and fairness. They signal civic standing, and they shape life prospects. So the consequences persist long after decisions are made. So they are very important. So when we talk about the problem of affirmative action and other forms of positive discrimination, disputes about these issues arise specific to these allocation points. So, and they often framed generally as disputes about outcomes or disputes about representation or efficiency. But these debates conceal a deeper institutional question. So the deeper institutional or structural tension is, well, as I say, liberal political orders commit to equal citizenship. That is the bedrock of the principle and the rule of law. Yet decisions at selection gates, be it admission or hiring, often reflect persistent social disadvantage. So societies are marked by unequal schooling, inherited wealth, racial hierarchy, or uneven access to health and opportunities. So the core tension is correcting disadvantage at the point of selection, but threatening legality, publicity, reciprocity of reasons, and the social base of self-respect that these institutions are meant to protect or secure. So the dissertation, or my dissertation, takes this collision at the starting point. So, and focuses on institutional design, gate-level decision-making, and justice under the non-ideal conditions. So, well, I basically base my research or dissertation on Rawls, but of course, so I discuss about, related topics about in dealing and analyzing the problems in relation to Nozick or Sidgwick, but today I will specific about Rawls here. So Rawls evaluates the basic structure of society, which he describes as the primary subject of justice because it distributes fundamental rights and shapes citizens' life prospects from the start. So ultimately, to design institutions that are free and equal citizens could publicly justify to one another. So what the basic structure of society is mainly supposed to do, as per Rawls, is supposed to maintain background justice over time, because he defines, you know, specific society, and the society is continuous for generation and generation. So it has to maintain the background justice so far, so that generations, you know, successive generations would have, you know, comparable advantage and fairness across times. So in particular, ensuring that the distribution of social starting positions remain fair, and this maintains background justice, as I've already discussed. This theory remains the most influential account of fair liberal society, as well some would agree or not. But even if Rawls is my central point, the dissertation also reconstructs Nozick's entitlement theory or Sedgwick utilitarianism against the same baseline. So the purpose is not to choose among them, but to expose Rawls's distinctive commitments and vulnerabilities, one. And not only this, it also moves beyond abstraction by engaging constitutional constraints, case-based analysis like that of some decisions from the US Supreme Court about college admission, public hiring, and procurement too. So what the dissertation is and is not. It is not a defense of affirmative action, and not also an indictment of affirmative action. Whether Rawls simply endorses or rejects affirmative action-related gate-level practices under non-ideal conditions. Rather, it aims not to replace it with a rival theory, but to test Rawls's architecture against lived disputes. What Rawls's theory can and cannot justify under non-ideal conditions. And it asks whether this gap can be narrowed internally, requires a constrained supplement, marks a genuine limit of justice as fairness. So now, let's talk a bit about the non-ideal baseline. That is the initial, you know, discussion of my dissertation. So this non-ideal baseline, the inquiry of the dissertation proceeds in stage. So first I talk and discuss about the problems. What are the problems as we live in this world? We are living in the non-ideal condition, but Rawls lives in an ideal, you know, society, and he has an ideal society that should be and will be governed by the two principles of justice. But we live here with all the disadvantages, with all the structural problems we have. So first sections, then after talking about these problems, then I talk about, you know, Rawls, then other theorists, and focus on selection gates. I only selected three selection gates. These are admissions, hiring, and procurement, and identified about lists of problems and tests in an non-ideal context. I identified almost lists of non-ideal problems, almost close to 14 I identified, but I cannot talk all of them here. I will be discussing some of them, and also test cases, about maybe more than 8 and something like that. Still, the dissertation is an ongoing one, so I will discuss some of them here so that we can have at least the understanding what I'm talking about. So let's start about an equal starting point. So as you know, current outcomes in education, work, public life reflect long-term accumulations, not a fresh start. So we all are come from different starting points, right? So even in without, you know, a formal barriers, resource gap persists, you know, uneven schooling, neighborhoods, family background, and wealth, everything, social standing, everything. So the expectations institutions hold toward different outcomes or different communities are shaped by structure, not accident. So selection rules today encounter applicants already shaped by these histories. Claims of fairness must be judged in present conditions, not in an idealized society that never existed. And the other one, maybe as an example, we can also talk about group and individual targeting. Any account that proceeds in the present must also acknowledge how poorly social categories correspond to current conditions. Historical injustice does not map cleanly onto current circumstances. For instance, not all members of disadvantaged groups remain disadvantaged, or not all outsiders are well off. So the distribution within social categories is wide, and the boundaries between them are frequently overlap. So if we, for instance, focused on group-based rules, well, it captures related structural constraints in one hand, but also it has also, you know, mislocate scarce opportunities. So it has a problem of either over-inclusion or under-inclusion. And if we target, for instance, individual-based rules, can better target current disadvantage, but also that mis-patterned effect is not visible in individual files. So the key question must be, when should a present departure from a single rule be clear to group membership, and when to individual condition? If it is clear to individual condition, all right, thank you. So what evidence can be required without intrusion or arbitrariness? If it is clear to group membership, how can rules avoid over-inclusion and under-inclusion? Let's see this one, distribution of burdens. So who pays is also another question, right? The question of who bears the cost cannot be avoided. Any rule applied to selection gate creates winners and losers. When a rule differentiates, some are passed over despite not having caused the underlying injustice, right? When a rule refuses to differentiate and amid persistent inequality, those shaped by constraint may lose repeatedly under claims of neutrality. Fairness in the present requires attention to how costs are distributed, not only to promised gains. So fairness also requires attention to repetition. When the same people bear concentrated losses across cycles, harm accumulates even if each round seems defensible publicly. So now let's see some of the tests. The test cases, they serve as a diagnostic tests, and they also actually show how these, you know, different problems, non-ideal problems, collide together, be it an equal starting point, be it equal treatment and its ambiguity, be it the group and individual target. You see how they collide, you know, together. So for instance, the first test case, consider two applicants meet the threshold for an academically demanding capacity-limited program and present the same composite score despite unequal opportunities to prepare. Let's say applicant A, limited curricula, heavy consular load, few credible signals. And applicant B, advanced courses, dedicated counseling, paid preparation. So the committee sees the same score on the same scale. So the question is, if equal treatment means applying the same rule to relevantly similar persons, what is relevant similarity? The score as printed or readiness relative to opportunity? So we have also a burden of justification issue. If the committee targets the printed score as decisive, requires justification for ignoring readiness given opportunity. If the committee treats readiness as relevant, requires justification for why identical scores do not settle equality question. And we have also public constraint. If readiness is relevant, what evidence can be used without violating privacy or inviting arbitrary narrative weighting? If readiness is not relevant, the institution chooses not to recognize differences that may see as relevant to equality in admissions. Any rule must be publicly defensible, avoid privacy intrusion, and distinguish between inequalities traceable to injustice and those a just society permits. Let's shift the case slightly. One applicant's score is higher, slightly lower than another's. So, but the file records severe upstream constraints. Outside, the applicant is control, and the constraints are plausibly connected to the score difference. The same ambiguity remains. Whether the score alone should decide the case, so we have two possible rules here. First, a rule that relies strictly on rank orders. I mean, price consistency, and it can be stated and justified simply. That's simple. Or a rule that permits the lower score to prevail in light of documented constraints, but must say how far such considerations can reach, must specify which factors are admissible, must locate the line between acknowledging background conditions and discarding the point of the measure. And reasons for lose out, for instance, if the lower score prevails, the institution must explain why the burden falls on this higher scoring applicant and why it does not fall on others whose files are similar in the same but not all respects. So without such reasons, the decision looks like discretion rather than judgment. Let's see the third one. Consider two applicants are indistinguishable on the metrics the institution says matter. But one applicant has a family connection to the institution. This fact is known to decision makers, but not part of the formal criteria. So if a tiebreaker is used, the rule must specify what counts as a legitimate tiebreaker and why it's legitimate. And we can raise the issue of legacy admission. I hope you're familiar with legacy admission at college level. So the institution must defend why legacy status is relevant to its purposes and a reason the losing applicant can recognize as reason. If legacy is excluded, but other non-achievement traits are allowed, for instance, core composition for pedagogical aims, the institution must explain the difference in public terms. So the justification, that means trade-offs, if any, must be stated publicly, justified in advance, and defended to those who bear the near-term burdens. So let's back to Rawls. So Rawls, he does not treat admissions, hiring, or procurement as freestanding moral sides. They are lower-tier rules that must implement principles fixed for the basic structure through the four-stage sequence. So we have four-stage sequences. First, we have the two principles at the OP, the original position, and we have constitution, we have legislation, and finally we have education and administration. So, and transitional measures cannot replace basic structure reform, as gate interventions cannot carry the full burden of correcting inequalities. So they can only operate within narrow limits while upstream reform progresses. But he offers limited guidance for administrators, institutions, and present tense selection decisions to manage gate level pressure, especially in societies that fall short of ideal conditions. And this is the argument of the dissertation. So the guiding inquiry, so the central question is, what can be done when background institutions remain defective and when inherited disadvantages continue to depress present performance? So can any form of gate-level action be reconciled with Rawls' priority structure, publicity requirements, equal civic status? Or does such practices mislocate his work of justice that Rawls assigns to background institutions? So a minimum Rawlsian supplementary practice. Transitional measures are not ruled out by Rawls, but they are heavily constrained. Within Rawls's architecture, the dissertation proposes a minimal supplementary gate practice that does not trade away equal status or relocate FAOE when fair equality of opportunity to administrators, and argue that transitional measures are permissible within Rawls's framework only when they remain public, rule-governed, applications of institutional purpose, and do not convert selection gates into sites of discretionary compensation for background injustices, either be it based on identity or the likes. So the conclusion is, based on this, Rawls's framework permits only a very narrow corridor for gate-level movement under non-ideal conditions, and two narrow zones appear. First zone, public ties, when candidates are substantively indistinguishable on all publicly announced relevant criteria, a publicly specified tiebreaker may be used. This is not an exception to equality. It follows from Rawls's rule of law requirements. If the metrics do not decide the case, the selection mechanism itself must be publicly non-arbitrary, must be public, non-arbitrary, and stated in advance. The justification must be role-related, stated in general terms, and must not signal second-class standing. So this is a small but real opening in Rawls's theory. So other than this, the one that we talked earlier, those, you know, test cases and problems are outrightly rejected according to his principles or according to his framework. The second zone, implementation of legislated opportunity scheme. The second zone arises when the gate level rule implements a general opportunity securing scheme already adopted at the legislative stage. So fair equality of opportunity is realized through public education, school finance, health policy, and labor regulation. If such a scheme specifies ex ante how opportunities are to be structured, administrators may be apply its terms at the gate. Here, the gate is not compensating individuals, it is executing public law. This is institutional, not discretionary. The gate does not respond to identity or narrative. It carries out a publicly adopted rule intended to secure comparable prospects independent of class of origin. Outside these two zones, Rawls's objections become very strong. All of them are discussed and tested in detail in the dissertation. So the dissertation, therefore, tries to show that Rawls is not silent about transitional justice, but does not license broad corrective discretion. And his framework produces tight constraints. His theory limits what institutions may do, even when injustice persists. So the dissertation continues. I'm still working on it. And thank you so much for your attention. Thank you. Appreciate it.
Thank you very much, Endak. You're perfect on timing as well. So now the word goes to Gonzalo Fernandez.
¿Cómo lo hacemos? ¿En inglés? ¿En castellano? ¿En inglés?
In English,
¿en inglés? Okay, sí. Okay, because this is like quite far from my usual topics, I'm going to try to be short and just make... Ah, sí, el micro. Ah, sí, es que me he cambiado aquí porque aquí es donde estaba la...
Sí.
Y si no, no me enteraba. So, I have like only six short and mostly propedeutical comments. So, the first one is, in several points, I had the impression that you claim that Rawls theories are not designed for non-ideal theories. That can be true to some degree, but if we define, as I think that you do, non-ideal theories, non-ideal situations, and as those situations in where the background conditions are not totally equal, then I would say that Rawls is perfectly aware that in our societies, not everyone has the same opportunities, a family, resources, talents. I mean, one of the first and most well-known, most striking and even like hard paragraphs of Rawls is this whole story about the natural lottery. So Rawls is well aware of background inequalities. In fact, his second principle is precisely designed to how to fairly deal with what? With inequalities in society. His whole theory is, okay, what are the fair ways to try to remediate some of the inequalities, of the background inequalities that we can find in our world. So maybe there it was just my miscomprehension, but So having said that, well, yes, another comment about roles. If you want, maybe you treat this in another chapter of your thesis, but if you want to somehow talk about what would roles say about affirmative action or how affirmative action fits with roles ideas, I think that one of your main concerns, among many others, should be to try to show in which way any form of discrimination, positive or negative, is coherent with his first principle of everyone should have the same basic right, well, the formulation that we are all aware. Because one could, maybe wrongly, but at first sight, like it seems like a plausible argument to claim that any form of discrimination is against the first principle, that the first principle as a basic right includes the right of an equal treatment from the law, from public institutions, and that affirmative action, what could keep reasoning, it's always a non-equal treatment before the law. So maybe affirmative action is not against Rawls' first principle, but that's something that need to be dealt with special care. Vale. I mean, one could always say that Rawls is perfectly okay with helping, with helping those that with less fortunate bad conditions, and that the way to do it, according to Rawls, is through economic redistribution and according to the second principle, according to the constraints of the second principle. In any case, so forgetting about Rawls, just focusing on the whole topic about affirmative action. I think that it would be very helpful to spend some time explaining what, to your mind, is discrimination. For example, imagine that near here there is a big important jail, and we know that a black Muslim woman, a short black Muslim woman, has escaped jail. If the police starts doing road controls, stopping only those people that fit that description, black, like with a hijab, woman, is that discrimination? So notice that I'm not talking about just general racial profiling. I'm talking about this very specific case. We know that a black Muslim woman has escaped jail. If the police starts to stop only the cars with drivers that fit that description, that is discrimination. That is acceptable discrimination, but discrimination nonetheless. I think that to have a clear dissertation about this topic, we first need to clearly define in a convincing way what is discrimination. And once we have done that, I think that we need to explain, okay, and what's wrong with discrimination? Why we think that discrimination is not a good thing, and therefore that affirmative action or positive discrimination needs justification. It only needs justification, but because we are assuming that this like traditional bad discrimination, it's wrong. Okay, why it's wrong? Because maybe if we have a clear and deep grasp with what's wrong with traditional non-positive discrimination, then we can more easily discover if some forms of affirmative action are acceptable. Because some stories of why discrimination are wrong are totally compatible with some forms of affirmative actions, but many other stories about what's wrong with discrimination equally forbid more benign, more positive or affirmative discrimination. No sé si this is clear. And to close my thing, I think that it would be also very like enriching, or it will help the reader understand your point, what you have on mind, what is your aim, to say something more about what kind of objective or aim are you, usually policies of affirmative actions have three main goals that are not exclusive among themselves. For example, equality of results, representation, or equality of opportunity. I think that it would, among many others, but those are the most discussed ones, I think it would be very helpful for the reader, and it will improve your dissertation, to be more explicit about when I talk about affirmative action, I talk about measures that try to achieve the one or several of these goals. And I think that that's also important, because depending of the goal that you're trying to achieve with these measures, some forms of affirmative action would be justified, or some theories about how to deal with inequality, with unequal back conditions, would be more or less coherent. So that's all.